From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the ventilation system of the building where you spend most of your days. Maybe it's work, home, an office. How's the airflow? How much have you learned about the way COVID spreads and how to handle it? New York State has just passed a law that might be the first of its kind in the country, a law intended to protect the quality of the air at work for thousands of New Yorkers. It's not clear yet if it will work. We know that in this pandemic, the vast majority of infections are passed indoors, often in poorly ventilated spaces. In a statement, Governor Andrew Cuomo said, quote, "When the COVID-19 pandemic began, it quickly became clear that New York's employers were not taking adequate steps to protect their workers from airborne infectious disease. The first in the nation New York HERO Act directs state agencies to create clear, enforceable health and safety standards that private employers have to follow to keep their employees and, by extension, their communities safe. It also gives workers a voice in the process, so employers aren't the sole arbiters of workplace safety from disease. This is a historic step forward for working people and a preventative measure that will ensure we are better prepared for the next public health crisis. I was proud to sign this bill into law and look forward to reviewing the new standards to protect workers and build a stronger New York," end quote. So yes, this is about COVID, but it's about other disease transmission too. Can we stop or slow down spreading of the common cold, for example? How about other viruses? How about the flu? Will this help? And what does this mean for workers who might be nervous about being back in the office? Our guests this hour include Dr. Emil Lesho, who's an infectious disease and internal medicine specialist at Rochester Regional Health. Dr. Lesho, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Cordello. Beth is chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano & Farrow. Beth, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan.
Dr. Lesho, do we have a better handle on how COVID spreads? And do you see this kind of effort from New York State as a wise one, as a reasonable one?
We continue to learn more and more about COVID every day. Initially, we've come a long way from what we used to know about it when it first emerged over a year ago. The main way COVID or SARS-CoV-2, the agent that causes it, spreads is through when we exhale air, and the droplets in that air find their way to people close by. It's kind of a hybrid between a full-blown airborne spread, such as tuberculosis and measles, which are highly contagious, and the droplet. So it's not fully airborne, but there is a ventilation airborne component to COVID-19.
Yeah, and you know, I certainly remember those early weeks of the pandemic when I was sort of wiping down groceries and wondering if I should wait 24 hours to touch the mail. In retrospect, I mean, I understand why we were taking those precautions. Do we look back at that and say, though, we've learned enough not to have to do that with at least with SARS-CoV-2 anymore?
Yes, I think you're right.
Is that fair?
I think that's fair. Again, when, you know, any new pathogen that we know little about, we have to be extra cautious. And at the time, you're looking at other similar viruses, you know, they can spread through contaminated hands, you know, and handshakes and when we touch doorknobs and then touch our eyes. But again, we've learned that, surfaces are not as important as poorly ventilated spaces and being close to a person that has COVID.
So listeners, as we go throughout this hour, we're going to go in a number of different directions with our guests who have very different and very important expertise for us here. If you've got questions about what we have learned about how COVID spreads, and maybe this is a good moment for us to reexamine that and make sure that we're up to speed as to the latest, you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Beth Cordello, we were in touch briefly a few days ago when we were first hearing about the New York HERO Act. From your perspective as an employment attorney, how significant is this move by New York State?
It's very significant. And it's a relatively short rollout time. So the New York Health and Essential Rights Act, otherwise known as the HERO Act, passed on May 5th. And it has largely two components. One, all private employers are to have infectious disease protocols for the prevention of spread of those diseases. And it goes through various elements that must be covered in the standards. It also directs the Department of Labor and the Department of Health to work together to release model standards. Employers will have the choice whether to adopt the model standards or adopt their own standards, which will be okay if so long as it meets the minimum requirements of the state standards. And it'll differ across different industries what those standards are. Originally, that was supposed to be put in place by June 4th. The act has since been amended to allow an additional 30 days for those standards to be published and for employers to adopt them. So that'll go into effect July 4th. And then effective November 1st, employers must allow for workplace safety committees to be formed, and these will largely be driven by non-managerial staff. And those committees will be able to review and approve standards and protocols that are put in place. They'll bring forth complaints that employers, you know, must address, and a variety of other things. It's the first of its kind, and so it is significant.
And that's a lot of power for workers who are, you know, they don't have to be unionized. They can form these workplace safety committees, and essentially the law says they should be able to have a say in how their own workplace policy to deal with infectious disease happens, right? I mean, it's not about unionization. Everybody, I guess, in a private workplace setting is going to have the chance to form these committees?
Well, that's right. So for those of you listeners out there who are familiar with union-organized workplaces, this is already relatively commonplace. Most collective bargaining agreements and, you know, especially in certain industries, provide for employee-led, you know, worker safety committees. This is the first time that it's going to be permissible. Employers must permit it. They don't have to mandate and set up these committees, but if employees want these committees, they must be allowed to have them in non-union settings. What's interesting and will remain to be seen is, you know, there's the federal OSHA laws, which govern workplace safety and health, and then there's the National Labor Relations Board, you know, that has certain rules and so forth with respect to these types of committees. There's a lot of speculation that these federal laws will preempt parts of this HERO Act. And so, you know, whether those challenges are brought forward, whether, you know, some provisions of this act will be found to be preempted by federal law remains to be seen.
Okay. So let me ask Dr. Lesho about where we are in understanding indoor-outdoor. You know, Dr. Lesho, I'm sure there have been outdoor infection spread, but almost all of the cases of either super spreader events or, you know, sort of bigger chains trace back to sometimes it was a restaurant and an indoor office setting a lot of the time. Are we pretty comfortable now knowing that COVID is by and large a concern of spreading when we are indoors?
I think what you just enumerated is very correct. Yes, I think it's primarily an indoor problem. We look at it, we try to simplify it as kind of a memory aid by the three V's. Okay, so vocalization, ventilation, and venue. And you can put those three together and come up with a risk assessment of, you know, people who are not protected by full vaccination, what their risk is of sharing some indoor space with a person who is infected themselves. So the first V, for example, if you're at an indoor game or something and people are screaming or they're singing, so that's the vocalization. That's one of the highest factors because you're generating more of those infectious droplets. The next V is the ventilation. If there's no air circulation or it's poor air circulation, then those infectious droplets persist, have longer to persist and find other people. And then the last V is what you just alluded to, the venue, indoors versus outside. And now another V I might add to that, and that's the variants. So we hear about these variants of interest or the variants of concern, like the B117 or the P1. We know also that certain variants can be more easily spread, and there are some of them.
I'm glad you bring up the variants just briefly. My understanding is that B117 has become dominant in this country. P1 is causing all kinds of havoc in Brazil right now. It does not account for a large percentage of cases in this country. It could eventually. And, you know, I don't know if we know everything enough to answer certain questions that listeners have had about this, Dr. Lesho, but listeners have been asking, are these more dangerous to children? Are they more transmissible in general? Are they more dangerous to adults? B117 and P1, how much do we know about them?
Well, we learned quite a bit about them. And for example, I guess we'll start with the good news. The B117, you know, for short, the colloquially expressed where it was first identified, the United Kingdom, the UK variant. We know for sure that that's more transmissible. We know that, though, the vaccines, and in some studies, well, I'm starting with the bad news, so it's more transmissible. And in some studies, not all studies, it's been more virulent. So it resulted in more severe disease. But what is consistent through a lot of studies is that, happily, the vaccine is very effective against the B117. They're a little less effective than against the South African variants and the Brazilian variants, but they're still effective at those. And so we know also how they, you know, if you're infected with that, how effective the monoclonal antibody cocktails might be. And if they have certain mutations, so a variant is kind of a different strain, if you will, that has a collection of specific mutations. Sometimes, and so you have to have every mutation to have that variant, to define the variant. Sometimes you just have one or two of those mutations. And sometimes that alone is enough to reduce effectiveness of some of the monoclonal antibody treatments. Initially, the sequencing effort in the United States was not very robust at all. We were sequencing only a very small fraction, so we were kind of flying blind. The United States has gotten a little bit better. More funds have been directed at that, and you know, happily, you know, we're learning more.
Yeah, and it's been fascinating. I mean, not in any sort of happy way to watch the spread of variants, but are we at the point now, Dr. Lesho, where at least so far, we're comfortable saying, if nothing else, the vaccines have not been, they haven't been beaten by these variants, that the vaccines give us the protection we need, even with the changing nature of the variants, and that, you know, there's always unknowns, but so far, so good?
Exactly. At this time, that's correct. So far, so good.
Okay. Is it possible? I'm sure it's possible. Is it likely that eventually there will be a variant that evades most or all of our immunization efforts?
Well, it's possible. It's definitely possible. As we go longer and longer and more people get vaccinated, it's less likely. And that's, you know, one excellent reason for, you know, encouraging vaccination. A mutation or a variant can only emerge if it has a chance to infect and reinfect others. As it's reproducing itself, that's when these arise. If you prevent that through vaccination, you deprive the virus the ability to mutate. So the quicker we come to what's called herd immunity, or, you know, the bar has been lowered a little bit, societal immunity, you know, the less likely we'll have the emergence of a real, you know, killer strain.
This hour is a conversation about what we know about COVID, how it spreads, how it has mutated, and how it might compare to other diseases that spread, because New York State is trying to address not only this pandemic, but all workplace-based infection and spread of infection with a new law that puts a pretty aggressive timetable on employers to make changes. And so Beth Cordello, who is the chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano & Farrow, how many employers are you hearing from? How quickly is this becoming obvious that this is something that employers are going to have to deal with? Whether it's, I guess, ventilation systems? I mean, is there a most common concern or place that employers are looking at dealing with this new law?
So, you know, I was getting a lot of calls about the HERO Act, but then this week, Evan, you know, just to throw some more things in the mix, you know, the CDC, as you know, issued its new guidance. That was a surprise. And then yesterday, Governor Cuomo announced that New York State, effective tomorrow, will be following that guidance. That was also a surprise for many. What does that mean for, and then an executive order was issued this morning, which was actually more vague than the press release yesterday. And that executive order, I think this was just an oversight, it didn't formally repeal previous executive orders regarding distancing, masking, et cetera, in the businesses. I think that the executive order issued this morning will be amended. I think it was intended to repeal the prior one, but it did not technically do that. So, you know, we have this in play where New York State businesses are being told, you know, that so long as you're following the CDC guidance, you can implement whatever you want in your workplace. But then also we have in connection with that the HERO Act that's coming down the pike, and very soon there will have to be, you know, infectious disease standards and protocols adopted very soon within these, you know, next probably 6 to 8 weeks. It's a very and a lot of agencies are going to need to weigh in. There's more questions than answers right now in terms of what employers should be doing, shouldn't be doing. In terms of, you know, HVAC systems, ventilations, to me that's one of the easier things. It makes sense. The other things that'll be a little bit more difficult is masking, distancing, you know, and how you treat your vaccinated staff versus unvaccinated staff. I think that'll be a little bit more complicated. The ventilation standards, I have not seen what the recommendations are, or if Dr. Lasho knows, you know, what the recommendations are in terms of where they are lacking now and where they need to be.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, Dr. Lasho, how about the ventilation standards? I'm wondering, in the last year, have we learned that we are sort of behind as a society and in a lot of workspaces on this? And does this extend to a value of addressing not just for COVID, but for influenza, common cold, other coronaviruses, et cetera?
Well, I'll start with the last part of your question and work backwards, because that's the easiest one. Yes, it does. I agree. And I agree with what the other guest had said, because with the rapidity at which the CDC seemed to reverse cause and, you know, give us all whiplash did not causes some concerns among healthcare epidemiologists. So, I know what they're trying to encourage people to get vaccinated. But we know that one of the most effective ways of preventing the spread of COVID is through masking, right? So, but yet nobody has to mask. So it's going to be interesting to see how vaccination status is determined and enforced. The air exchange is what hospitals struggle with a lot. So we have different needs depending on the type of patients that we're looking at. So, for example, if we have a highly immunocompromised patient, we want to make their room what's called positive pressure, so nothing harmful can get in. So there's a state of positive pressure where the air in that room is continually being forced out. On the other hand, when you have a patient with a fully airborne disease like tuberculosis, chickenpox, measles, you want to have the reverse of that. You want to have a negative pressure room. And so these are expensive. And one thing we learned from COVID, and I'm sure I can't comment to what's in, you know, industry, and, you know, but I know it's probably very similar to the dilemma that healthcare institutions face, and that is what we call, from epidemiologic perspective, value engineering downward. So when a new hospital is designed, the infectious disease team and the infection control consultants also typically make recommendations as to how many of those rooms you would need. And we know we have recommendations from ASHRAE, which is the, I don't remember what that stands for, but it's like the American Society of Heating, Cooling, Ventilation Engineering or something like that. And we know the number of air exchanges per hour that each type of disease needs. And we recommend that. But because of the expense and because of the trickiness, they're often not, you know, we ask for 20 per every, 400 beds or something, and you don't get that amount. So It's expensive sometimes. It's tricky, but I know that some institutions, you know, including pubs I've heard about in the news, have, you know, went through some lengths to successfully implement some air purifying devices, you know, UV light. We learned that UV light is really effective at, you know, killing the virus.
But some of this, it sounds to me, Dr. Lesho, it sounds like when you talk about this ventilation, some of it really does have an impact versus some of the, you know, early in the pandemic, there was a combination of hygiene theater and sort of grifting where, you know, these companies were promising,
right,
we've got the spray that kills the virus,
right,
you know, things like that. Whereas the actual ventilation system, what you're telling us is it does matter. It does have an impact. That's true also for the common cold, for influenza. I mean, if we had better ventilation.
Less so, but there was another question that was asked from a news organization that said, well, are we going to get more colds when we take the masks off? Again, I think we can all agree, or looking back, we say, well, you know what? I didn't get as many colds, or
yes,
I hardly got any colds last year. That's because of the mask. Most ventilation systems didn't change one bit, but we were a little bit more attentive to masking, distancing, and hand hygiene. So, again, it's kind of disease specific. So for the more airborne spread a disease is, the more ventilation changes or improvements are going to matter.
Okay, and it's impossible to predict what the next illness is going to be, but some of this, the governor says, Beth Cordello, is about not just COVID, but looking forward and creating safety standards at work to prevent the spread of disease. I mean, do you have employers saying, you're making me incur an unbearable expense here? I mean, do you have some that feel like this is too much?
The whole past year and a half has been so too much on so many levels.
Fair.
And we don't know yet what's going to be, you know, required specifically, especially with respect to, you know, ventilation, et cetera. I mean, there are already building codes and rules, and, you know, I have not seen or heard, you know, if you're, you know, up to code for your industry and your building. I don't know what beyond that, you know, and I'm not talking about hospitals or healthcare settings. That's different when you're treating people who are sick.
Mm-hmm.
But just for, you know, for other workplaces and buildings, you know, I really don't know what they're going to be looking for in terms of changes beyond, you know, being to code otherwise. So, you know, hospitals, you know, that sort of ventilation that's needed is very expensive, but, you know, the average office, I would assume, does not need that level of airflow and ventilation systems put in place.
And I just want to make sure. I just want to make sure I understand what you're going to be doing then, Beth, as this spring into the summer, as employers watch New York State for these guidelines. Is your job going to be up on exactly what they have to do? So you're working with clients to say, okay, this is what the state says you've got to do. Like, let's go over it. So you're ready to make sure that you're up to standard. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. So what I'm doing is, you know, there's a number of balls being juggled in the air, if you will, in terms of, okay, in light of, you know, the announcements this week and the HERO Act that, you know, that's going to be coming into play more as we head into summer. You know, do I mandate a vaccinated workforce? Do I instead incentivize a vaccinated workforce? You know, how do I work out the fact that unvaccinated individuals will have to be masked and still keeping their distance and all these things? Can they go to the communal coffee pot and use the coffee pot? Are people going to be meeting in person, but that unvaccinated person, you know, can't go into the meeting? You know, are they revealing their private health information by continuing to wear a mask? Because it's not just unvaccinated people, it's immunocompromised people. So, you know, do I have to still do the screening? Do I still have to do these things? And, you know, until we hear more specific direction from the various agencies that oversee these things, you know, just modifying the guidance as we go. And it's very industry specific, you know, what I might recommend for a business that regularly interacts with the public or regularly interacts with, you know, vulnerable populations might be different than what I would recommend to a business where everybody is in their own office and not interacting with the public.
Okay, Dr. Lesha, does that make
it's changing all the time?
Does that make sense to you, Dr. Lesha?
I fully agree with it, and I couldn't have said it better. I mean, that what she said is what we're grappling with, and why we're maybe disappointed is too strong a word, but concerned about just ripping off everybody's masks. You know, it was becoming. It's not that hard to wear a mask, and there's organizations that feel, I think one includes the American Academy of Pediatrics, that, for example, that children who can't get vaccinated are being put at unnecessary risk through this. So some of us wish that CDC had taken a more stepwise, incremental approach. For the reasons and the difficulties in implementing all the scenarios that Ms. Cardello just enumerated for us.
So on the subject then of where this is going to have to happen, I don't think schools is on the list. And let me read an email from a listener named Anthony who says, Evan, this says for private employers, so I can't imagine how well this would be enforced if the public employees like myself haven't had any say already. We're really screaming into a void at this point and just hoping for the best on a daily basis. I and other teachers reached out to all levels of government and have never gotten a response. And I'm at the conclusion that short actual deaths to teachers or students, the media and the government will continue to let the situation play out as it is. And to be clear, I do believe schools can be open safely. It is happening across the country. Anthony is saying just not in the district where he teaches. So, first of all, Beth Cardello, this does not look like this New York State law. This doesn't touch schools, right? This is for private employers?
Right. So the CDC guidance and New York State's adoption of it, you know, that does not include the schools, doesn't include nursing homes, healthcare settings, public transit, correctional facilities. You know, that masks are still required in those settings, to be clear. In terms of the HERO Act, that is just for private employers. It is not for any type of public employer.
Okay. Dr. Lesho, how do you feel about how schools have tried to handle this pandemic, especially with kids coming back to classrooms?
Well, my wife is a teacher, and I agree with everything that Anthony, the email said. My wife's a teacher, and initially we were concerned. A lot depends on the school district. Practically all school districts are financially resource constrained. So they were having difficulty maintaining 6 feet. There was a study that came out that said 3 feet is just as good as 6 feet, but I'm somewhat skeptical of that study, reading the methods and stuff in detail. I'm sure we all have been in schools, and those schools, the ventilation is quite suboptimal. There is no ventilation. There are, old-fashioned radiator, hot water radiator heaters. So I know that even though I know that the CDC guidelines don't apply to healthcare organizations and schools, but the concern is that children go to more places than schools. And that's what has some parents concerned. Can they safely take them to the grocery store? What if you are immunocompromised? Is the person standing next to you in the grocery store or in, somewhere? Are they vaccinated or so?
Yeah, and I think about schools, Dr. Lesho. I think about places where they've got plexiglass dividers. Restaurants did this. And New York State has been sort of on this train for a while saying, well, 6 feet, but if you've got those dividers, 3 feet. My understanding, Dr. Lesho, is we've learned enough to say that those indoors, those plexiglass dividers, don't really do you much good because the particulate stuff kind of goes up and down, and that was sort of hygiene theater that doesn't actually provide a scientific basis for protection. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it helps. You know, it might not. It's not the full answer. It's not one of the most important things. But sure, those barriers do help. You know, it's just in case. For example, you could imagine it would reduce the burden, the germ burden. Like if you're at the bank or something, or you're and you sneeze, even though you might lift up your hand or your elbow, a lot of that might be deflected by those barriers. So I'd say they're somewhat effective, but I wouldn't necessarily say they're all theater. I'd say, they're a reasonable attempt with what we knew at the time and what we have.
All right, very good. Well, we've got a pile of listener questions for our guests, and we'll take it on the other side of this break here with Dr. Emil Lesho, who's an infectious disease and internal medicine specialist at Rochester Regional Health, and Elizabeth Cordello. Beth is the chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano and Farrow, who have been working with employers who have to understand this new law from New York State that is designed to set standards, to allow employees to work in committees on those standards, and to make sure that there's proper ventilation and protection, not just for COVID, but for other diseases or even future diseases. God forbid a future pandemic. So we're talking about all of that and more with our guests on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, how can trust be built between the community and local police? United Christian Leadership Ministry plans to explore that question as part of its upcoming Community Police Summit. We'll talk with Reverend Lewis Stewart and veteran law enforcement leader and former deputy mayor of Rochester, Cedric Alexander, about that. Then in our second hour, the latest in Lyme disease research and treatment. Talk with you on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So back to some feedback from listeners. Andrew says, this law seems to shift the balance of power dramatically in favor of workers. It seems like workers will be able to say that they are not satisfied with whatever their employer has done and just walk out with the expectation that they would still be paid and they can set the demands for safety standards. That's from Andrew. Beth Cordello, what do you think?
So there are very strong employee protections in the HERO Act. Aside from, you know, the two main provisions that I just discussed, the law also provides that if an employee believes in good faith that the workplace is not safe from an infectious disease prevention standpoint, they can refuse to go to work. Employees can raise complaints and concerns without reprisal. Employers must investigate and take corrective action. The law as initially written, it was amended almost right away, as initially written said that employees could sue and recover a variety of different types of damages if the employers were not following their plans or maintaining a safe workplace. That was met with immediate outrage by the business community, saying there's going to be a ton of frivolous lawsuits brought by, you know, opportunistic lawyers and workers. So those portions were walked back relatively significantly. So now if an employee wants to bring a lawsuit, they first have to provide notice to the employer of what they believe is unsafe or is a violation, and the employer has 30 days to take corrective action. If within that 30 days corrective action is not taken, the employee can sue. The amount of damages they can recover, liquidated damages have gone away. They can recover attorney's fees and other damages they may have incurred. For example, if they were fired, they could recover lost wages. But if the court determines that this lawsuit was frivolous, the court can make the employee and or the employee's lawyer pay the business's legal fees for having to defend the suit. So that was meant to curtail frivolous actions that might have otherwise been brought.
Interesting. Do you have regular contact with businesses that are working in a situation now where maybe they're asking their employees to come back to work? I mean, I think about it, so I park at the High Falls Garage, and it's been a year. It's been more than a year since I've had to go all the way up to the fourth floor to park. Usually I parked on floors 4, 5, and 6 because it's usually filled, and it's been empty for most of a year. Now we're starting to creep into level 3 again, and slowly, it seems like in the last week, more cars showing up. And so, Beth, are you hearing from employers who are saying, look, we are ready to get people back in the building, but we've got people who won't come back to the building? And I'm not talking about restaurants in which workers are saying, you're underpaying me, I'm not going to work at all. I'm saying employees who've been working remotely and then telling their employers, no, for various reasons, including safety or otherwise, I'm not coming back.
So that's been a huge issue that I've been talking to businesses about on a daily basis is, you know, a lot of businesses that have been remote for this entire time or nearly this entire time are starting to resume, relatively normal pre-COVID operations, given that, that almost, everybody can now get the vaccine quite easily now. And they're having trouble because for, there's just, psychologically for a lot of people that have been, working from home, some people are excited to be back and wanting to be back, mm-hmm. but there is a pretty decent portion of the workforce that does not want to come back. And they're saying, listen, I've been doing my job just fine remotely for all of this time. I don't, whether they're vaccinated or not vaccinated, they don't feel as though the risk justifies the return to the office. And that's a real thing that employers are grappling with, because many of these positions, they were never designed to be fully remote. And while, it was, you could get by on how it was being performed during this time, it's not optimal. It's not how it was intended to work. Other employers, on the other hand, are revisiting whether they'll ever be fully back in the office again, just because productivity was fine while it was remote. So, that's a different scenario. But for those that are looking to go back to operations that are more similar to what they were pre-COVID, there is that portion of the workforce that's resistant to returning. And, how that gets dealt with is very much on a case-by-case basis. For example, if somebody has a disability, then you have to have that dialogue and that interaction regarding whether continued work from home, is a reasonable accommodation that must be given, and that sort of thing.
So I know this is going to continue to be an interesting, I know it's not going to happen overnight. We're not going to know the permanent impact on remote work, even remote schooling. But I do know employers are going to be dealing with this, and I'm sure we'll continue to track this and talk about it. I want to get Allison's email. She asked, Evan, it seems like we knocked the flu out. Will the flu come back? Well, number one, this new law is intended to try to prevent spread of various diseases, not just COVID. But I think, Dr. Lesha, what Allison is talking about in the email is the fact that we have distance and we have masked, and therefore the flu cases are remarkably low this past flu season. And she's wondering, should we just assume that it'll be back as normal in the future? Yeah. What do you think, Dr. Lesha?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. It comes up quite often. And as you said, we were amazed by the small, almost no flu cases this year. And most of us attribute that to the masking and the hand hygiene and the mm-hmm. distancing. But so another corollary question is, well, am I going to get worse colds or something like that? Well, you got to keep in mind, like, it's what happens, say, for example, when a new mom puts the baby in daycare, and then, that mom has never had so many upper respiratory infections, because he has to get used to a whole new plethora of different respiratory viruses. So that's likely to happen, unless for some reason masks come back, during the flu season. But the flu vaccine is not as effective as the COVID shots, unfortunately. They're still very important, and they still reduce hospitalizations and severe disease, but the COVID vaccines have been some of the most highly successful vaccines. So, and then there's also competition among all, just like humans and animals compete for, spaces and resources and stuff, so do the pathogens. So, and that's what we're seeing with the United Kingdom variant, the B.1.1.7. For some reason, that variant is so fit, is so well adapted. It's elbowed out all some of the other variants of concern we were worried about. They just didn't have time to get a foothold. So sure, I think we have to be mindful and continue to get, and then we have to see when, we don't know yet how long the immunity is going to last to COVID from these vaccines. So there's a good possibility we'll have to get a booster shot for that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of assume we're all going to be living in booster world, just as we, or even seasonal variant, updated vaccine world with COVID as we are with flu. Is that your assumption, Dr. Lesha?
Yeah, that's my assumption.
Okay. Is there any reason to think right now that the vaccines are likely to be 6 months, 12 months, or much longer, or is this just a wait and see?
Well, the studies, we know we're pretty confident that we're good for 6 months. And as we, it's a part of it's a wait and see, though. So I think you can confidently, you know, if you're a normal, healthy person and you don't have immune compromising illnesses or you don't take immunosuppressants, you know, chances are you've had a good response to the recommended number of doses, depending on the vaccine, and you should be, you know, fairly well protected for at least 8 to 10 months. That we're pretty certain about. Once we start getting out to about a year, we have to wait and see.
And I just
there are ongoing studies. There are ongoing studies right now.
Yeah, sure. And I just want to highlight one other point before I get back to some listener feedback. You know, you've been talking about masking this hour, Dr. Leshow, and there's kind of a strange phenomenon going on of people who were either anti-mask or mask skeptics who feel like the CDC order somehow vindicates them,
right.
which it unfortunately it does not. The masking has been one of the most effective tools we've had in this pandemic. We know that that's borne out by actual research and data.
Yes.
And so not only does the CDC measure not validate an anti-mask position, but what I don't understand is this idea that we're now going to shame people if they're more comfortable in masks at all here. I mean, I have a friend who has cancer. I know all kinds of people who would need to be masked anyway. And I think the valuable thing to do is to be kind, to not assume that someone is behaving in a way that you think is silly or you don't like and you need to tell them about it. I think most people are not trying to be dangerous. I also do wonder, I wonder if you agree with that. And I wonder if you think, I talked to one of your colleagues from Toronto who thinks that we could see kind of mask season, kind of maybe during the flu or the cold months, we could see masks become more common, at least, if not fully adopted throughout society every year, more common in the colder months, kind of like we see in perhaps Asian societies or otherwise. What do you think?
I echo and fully agree with what you said, and I have the same hope as well. And the other reason why you said, you know, that somehow there's a misperception that the change in masking policy vindicates the anti-maskers is, you know, unfortunate. And that's one of the reasons why many of us thought kind of this, you know, immediate reversal of course was not well done. Had they taken it in a more, you know, incremental strategy and said, okay, let's do indoors and let's do this and let's do that, it would have been harder, I think, for the anti-maskers to perceive, you know, vindication. But I can see their point. You know, it's, you know, I was hope, you know, and again, it with anything, it can become societally enculturated, like you had mentioned in the Asian communities. It's unfortunately, beginning with the last administration, presidential administration, there was too much politics with all of this. And there was no way that we don't ascribe politics to smoking. You wouldn't say you wouldn't walk into a restaurant or a grocery store or something and light up a smoke and say this is my right to smoke. But yet we do that with COVID, and COVID is far more deadly. So I hope what you said. I hope people will try to be kind and get rid of the politics and, you know, respect other people's, you know, right for safety or their, you know, desire to wear a mask. And we'll see.
Do you think we could see a mask season kind of
yes.
during the cold? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it would be easy to find scientific evidence, as you just alluded to support that.
Mm. So let me just grab a few questions from listeners. A couple questions on businesses and what they're going to have to do with ventilation systems, especially if they rent. Mary says, Evan, how will the standards work for businesses that have current leases? And on this similar subject, Patrick says, we must remember that most businesses rent space. They do not own it. Then you have the dynamics of a triple net lease, which requires the person renting the space to maintain it to their business's specificity. For example, upgrading a bathroom in a restaurant occupied in a strip mall. Who pays for that? The company that owns the strip mall or the business renting the space? In a triple net lease, I bet it's the business owner, not the property management company. A lot of things to untangle here. Beth Cordello, what do you think?
That's right. And the answer is within the question. There's lots of things to untangle here. I would encourage businesses that lease their space to look at their lease and, you know, work with their landlords to figure out, you know, what can be done and where the responsibility lies with whom and who has, you know, who has to pay for it, who has to oversee it, et cetera. But all of that was exactly correct, and we don't have all the answers yet.
Okay, what's the biggest unanswered question with this new law then, Beth?
Wow. the biggest unanswered question, I guess, you know, will it achieve its goals?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what will employees do with it? You know, to a large extent, laws are only good to the extent they're enforced by the public, and it's really up to the workers, you know, are they actually going to form these committees and perform the work that would have to be done under those committees to enforce the provisions of this law? Are they going to, you know, bring these concerns? I think, you know, whether the law is effective at preventing infectious disease is a big question that remains to be seen, and whether, you know, workers will, you know, fully exercise their rights under it, I think remains to be seen.
I do want to believe, Dr. Lesho, that there's one change that's going to come out of this, which is, and I've said this before, but I think it's something that we need to keep talking about, which is that if we're not careful, we'll go back to a society where people regularly come to work sick. Now, some of that I understand is workers who feel pressured that they cannot miss.
Mm-hmm.
But even now, I know we're in allergy season. So, for example, you know, I've got colleagues who are on the air and they have allergies. I have allergies. And starts thinking, interesting. Did they come to work sick? I hope that we don't feel like we have to do that anymore, I guess is what I'm saying. What do you think?
Well, not only that, but, you know, one of the different, you know, if you remember SARS-1, for example, it's a close example of what we'll describe here in a moment. But there's also pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic spread, which is very important. We learned that especially in the healthcare settings, in nursing homes and in the hospital. We had outbreaks associated when the tracing was done and the investigations were done, the seeds of the outbreak were set by an employee or a visitor who was feeling fine, because the SARS-2, unlike SARS-1, you're fully infectious right before you test positive or develop symptoms, and that makes it really hard to control. The good thing about SARS-1 and why it wasn't so bad relatively is that you weren't maximally infectious until you had symptoms. So that eliminated the whole pool of asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission, which was very important for COVID.
Mm-hmm. Well, Beth Cordello, as we get ready to wrap the program here, tell me what you would advise businesses to start doing as they get ready for this, what this new law may mean for them.
So, you know, if they haven't already, they need to figure out what their position is on vaccinations. Are you going to mandate it? Are you going to encourage it? Are you not going to implement either of those things? And you know, how are you going to deal with that? That's something that needs to be sorted out. Businesses that are in business right now, they should have protocols already in place. They need to look at what those protocols are and compare to what's already listed out in the law, you know, start making those changes so when the standards come out, it'll be less of a significant change. And they need to start training their managers and supervisors to be aware, you know, because those are the frontline people who are communicating with staff on a regular basis. You know, what's happening, what they need to be aware of, and how to deal with these things.
Okay. And Dr. Lesho, what do you want to leave with listeners as we move toward the warm months? We're hitting 80 degrees this week. A lot of feelings are changing about, you know, what the CDC said and what businesses are mandating or not. What do you want to leave with people?
Well, I agree with Beth that for the employee side of the house and for others and schools and everything, it's the CDC has made it all about vaccination now. So it's the challenge is going to be whether or not it's mandated or encouraged or incentivized. I would leave listeners and emailers with this that, you know, I would encourage people to get vaccinated. as soon as they can. If they can, I would say that the vaccines are safe and very effective. And, you know, if you are not vaccinated, I would ask people to be considerate and kind and wear a mask, because you don't know if the person next to you has an immune illness or for various reasons, allergy or something else, couldn't get the vaccine.
And Beth Cordello, just in 15 seconds, I want to squeeze it in because listeners were asking. Employers can, or businesses can, deny entry based on vaccination cards. We're going to see more of that?
Yes.
The answer, yes. Short answer to that is yes.
We have another show on that.
but short answer is they can do that.
Yes.
Yeah, and I expect we'll continue to see more potentially of that. Beth Cordello is the chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano & Farrow. Thanks for explaining this and keeping us up to date on it, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Amy Lesho, infectious disease and internal medicine specialist at Rochester Regional Health. Always appreciate your expertise, Dr. Lesho. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our thanks to the whole crew here, Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson. Our thanks to Barsook Records and Rah Rah Riot for the music. And thanks to you for listening. This is Connections, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.